Senate Resources Committee to order. Today's Friday, January 25th. Wow, it's loud in here. Let the record reflect that it's 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator McGuire, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator French, and myself, Senator Giesel. Don't see any other elected officials. Did I not mention you, Senator French?
No. I was exchanging pleasantries with Senator Bishop. Right. It did look like a hand signal, so forgive me.
All right.
I feel like I'm in an auction. I'll keep my hands down.
The audio is very
hot. It is hot, yeah.
I feel like we're in a cave, but oh well, it's better than not enough video or audio, right? In any case, excused absence today is Senator Faircloth. So on the agenda today, we're going to open with Senate Bill 29, which we heard presented at our last meeting. We're holding public testimony today. It will be a 30-minute time period, and I will be enforcing a 3-minute time limit on folks testifying. So, got a list? All right, thank you. And if we have folks online, we'll get that list also. So let me get my timer started up here. All right, so the first person on the list to testify is Andy Rogers. Welcome, Andy, and as you take your seat, folks that are testifying, if you would identify yourself and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Dyson, members of the committee. My name is Andy Rogers. I am with the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, and I'm their deputy director. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 29. My hope is that this will pass quickly through committee and be passed by the Senate, and we'll see similar action on the House side with HB 80. This bill has the full support of the Alaska Chamber membership. In fact, it's one of the positions advanced by membership and approved this fall at our legislative priority forum. In addition to that specific position on this topic, wastewater discharge, our cruise ship industry in general, touches on a couple of our other positions. I have some notes here to make sure I don't miss anything. One of those is advocating for legislation and regulations that are based on sound science as opposed to a precautionary method. The recently released results of the science panel, I'm sure you guys are probably more familiar with those than I am, but they indicate that the wastewater discharge from our cruise ships is currently meets a higher standard than most, if not all, of our Alaskan municipalities. I think that this is a really encouraging set of results for an industry that has such a large economic impact, not just to our coastal communities, but also deep into the interior and into all parts of the state. Companies like Alaska Amphibian Tours in Ketchikan, Alaskan Brewing right here in Juneau, these are employers that generate revenue for these communities that are not directly tied to the cruise ship industry, but does rely on them for their revenues. Moving to the interior of Alaska, companies like Pike's Landing, Hot Licks Ice Cream, who I believe, in addition to helping create the Alaskan experience for our guests, also has contracts to provide ice cream to the cruise ship lines. We have members as far as Nome who benefit from guests coming to our state by sea, Bering Air, Nome Adventure Tours. I mean, these are creative ideas that aren't necessarily associated with Skagway, with Ketchikan, with Juneau, but that rely on the economic impact and the revenues generated and the jobs created in part by this industry. So I guess in closing, and I have some prepared comments to leave for the committee, I'd like to thank you again for hearing this. I do hope that it passes through Senate Resources quickly, and I would encourage the members of the committee to work with the rest of the Senate body to pass this quickly and take advantage of the permitting window that we have, with the general permit coming to a close soon. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. The next person to testify on the list is Bob. I think it's James, or is it Jones?
James.
James. And if you could spell that for the record, please.
My name is Bob Janes, J-A-N-E-S. I live here in Juneau. I'm a tour operator in Juneau. And, of course, being a tour operator, I make my living, my family's living, and many friends, neighbors here in Juneau are very dependent on the cruise industry. So I felt compelled to come today, although I had to question whether I really was qualified to be here. I am not a scientist, and I think this subject is all about science. It really is. As you deliberate this bill over the next few days or weeks, I really hope you're able to look at the findings of the science advisory panel, because that's how I have been able to clear my mind on my ability to come and speak. I read a great deal of their report, and I believe it's well done. This body appointed that committee 3 years ago to bring to us as much fact as we can and separate our emotions from fact. And I think if I can leave here with no other message than to hope that you will do the same thing in your decision over the next few weeks, then I will feel good about my being here. So thank you for having me.
Mr. Janes, before you go, could I just ask you, what is your position on the bill? I wasn't clear.
Oh, okay. I'm supportive of the passage of this bill simply to help clear some of the questions that the business community needs cleared in order to move forward with decisions and with commitments. Although I do know that times change, and in 2 or 3 years, we probably will be looking at this again and under new facts, new circumstances. So keep in mind, at least I try to keep in mind, that every decision we make is going to be followed up by a new decision in a few years. We're never going to solve a problem quickly and easily. So, unfortunately. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Let's see. The next person who wishes to testify is Carla Hart. Welcome, Carla.
Thank you. My name is Carla Hart. I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. And I'm going to speak more to the procedure and the framework than the specific science, which I'm not qualified to speak to. The rush on this bill does not seem warranted or appropriately. Most importantly, the science review process of the scientific advisory panel is not yet complete. The board or the group issued a draft report in November 2012. They have not issued a finalized report, and the anticipation is that there would be some review and some peer discussion and some further work that goes into a group written report to make sure that they have a final report, and that has not been done or issued yet. The cruise industry, and the bill calls for sunsetting the scientific review panel before they finish their work, which is upsetting to me as well. The cruise industry consistently expresses in other issues relating to taxes or to any regulation that they have a long planning time frame. And the artificially created urgency here by the governor of not having the permits issued for the spring, and we have to get this done right now because the permits are coming in summer season. I expect that the cruise industry is prepared to go forth if we have the existing law. I don't think that they would put their whole industry at risk to not be prepared to go forth under the existing law. So I don't think that there's actually the urgency that's being presented. And the risk of quick action in your part is that you'll betray the voters of Alaska who voted to have this higher standard of clean water. Let's see, I just come from the House. So the volume and size of the ships warrant special consideration. Most of these ships are larger than the communities of Alaska, and cumulatively these ships represent an incredible population increase in Alaska. So it's not a small scale of pollution that we're talking about. If an Alaska community doesn't meet discharge standards, it's in our front yard. We know where it comes from, we know where it is, and we know who's responsible, and we have to clean it up. Ships discharge anywhere, so remote areas that you might go to for subsistence harvest or for commercial fishing or whatever that you might think are clean because they're far away from any apparent discharge could actually be getting a pretty substantial burden over time and over all of the ships that are going on. Because a lot of these things are heavier metals that bioaccumulate, we don't know what that could be or what it could do. The chamber representative asked for action based on sound science rather than a precautionary principle. I think that we all know that regulations such as the EPA regulations are a blend of science and politics. They certainly weren't adopted in a vacuum, and I'm sure that the industry at various levels had input into the EPA regulations. We do know now that the impacts of very small amounts of toxics, undetectable under technologies of a few years ago, have really significant impacts on people. So I would ask you to slow down, take your time. The cruise industry will survive another year with this, and Alaskans will appreciate the chance for good consideration. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Carla. The next person signed up to testify is Guy Archibald.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. It's Archibald, A-R-C-H-I-B-A-L-D, and I'm currently employed with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, and I'm representing them here today. Prior to that, I spent 20 years as an environmental chemist and microbiologist. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council is a broad coalition of many conservation groups, native organizations, communities, fishing groups, small-scale mill operators and individuals. We've operated in Southeast Alaska for over 40 years. Because SB 29 is based on the science panel report, I'd like to make a few brief comments about the science and the science panel report. In particular, the comparison with loading from natural rivers, the comparison of cruise ships to land-based treatment facilities, mixing zones, and some of these treatment options that were examined. Comparing cruise ship wastewater loadings with a natural source such as the Mendenhall River is really not sound science on a number of reasons. The form of the element matters. Whether it's in its total form or its dissolved form. The science report does not make that distinction. I could eat a handful of copper pennies, pre-1982, of course, and have no ill effects. But if I take that same amount of copper and dissolve it into water and drink it, the effects are likely fatal. So the form matters. The type that the oxidative state, sorry for the chemistry, that also matters. These heavy metals come in various oxidative states. Some of them are absorbed by life, some of them are not. For instance, your body will absorb iron in the ferrous state, but it will not in the ferric state. The science report does not make that distinction. The source of the contamination matters. We do know the Copper River up north has a high level of copper in it. It often exceeds the water quality criteria for aquatic life. But those fish have had thousands of years and hundreds of generations to adapt to that level of copper in the water. Science tells us that even a small increase in the amount of copper is still detrimental to fish that are even adapted to high levels of copper in the water. And kind of at the final level, it's a false comparison. The argument that a cruise ships only contribute a fraction of the copper than the Mendenhall River is somewhat the same logic my teenagers used to use. It's like, well, Dad, everybody's doing it. Why can't I? It really has no place in a science-based report.
I'll let you summarize, and then we're happy to take your written testimony.
Okay. I asked that the science, if SB 29 is to continue, that the science panel not be sunsetted, but that the report be finalized and published for peer review, which is the norm for scientific reports. I further ask that the end of pipe compliance with water quality criteria to be to be retained as an incentive for the industry to do a better job, as what's happened with the land-based treatment systems. And thank you.
Thank you. And do, if you'd like to leave your written testimony, please feel free to do that. My staff will take it if you'd like to do that. All right, let's see. The next person that signed up is Chip Toma.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Chip Toma. I'm president of Responsible Cruising in Alaska. I have a handout for the committee that's got a chart on the back of it that I'll be speaking to, and if that's possible to distribute, that would be wonderful.
If my staff will take it.
I appreciate it. So rather than, of course, read my testimony, I will hand that out to you and just summarize and answer a couple of questions from your hearing the other night. The preference of Responsible Cruising in Alaska is that in the future, all ships coming to Alaska, all large cruise ships, deposit their waste in federal waters. And luckily, we are coming to the point with the size and the configuration of these ships that they are able to hold their waste for 5 days or more. And they are able to complete their trip in Southeast, exit Southeast Alaska, deposit in the Gulf of Alaska, and then either head north or head back down south. The other aspect of this is all ships now are being built with flex pipe, which does not have copper or any metals in it. So once we phase out these copper ships that are being run primarily, the ones that are over the limits or the Princess Cruise Lines, they were built all 30 years ago, of copper ships throughout the entire staterooms and galleys and everywhere else. Once those ships are phased out by the Princess Line, we're getting down to dealing with ships that are either clean or practically clean or depositing their waste in the Gulf of Alaska or at the Juneau Treatment Plant, which Princess does right now. So all those aspects are good. We're all coming to a good conclusion, I think, in the long run. In the short run, I think we ought to keep these standards and just give these guys a few more years of extension, because every year we're making advancements. And as I mentioned, these charts in the back, I'll just go ahead and speak to this. Yesterday, we had a comment about the bunker water, asking about the quality of the bunker water. So I went ahead and made calls to all the water superintendents of the three major bunker towns, Ketchikan, Juneau, and Skagway. And I asked them flat out, what is your copper count in your bunker water that you're delivering to the cruise ships? The guy in Ketchikan had a very interesting story. He was the first one. He said, I had a high copper count, 17 parts per billion, but I had 70 parts per billion lead. So I went down to the dock and I looked, and there was our brand new metal ball valve that we had just bought, India made, and I took that ball valve off and replaced it with a plastic one. We did a new test, an 8-hour test, let the water settle, and it came back 2 parts per billion under our water quality standards and 0.6 parts per billion lead. The source was obviously the ball valve. I called Skagway. So we now know that Ketchikan's water is 2 parts per billion. And this is after it's treated. That's going through the treatment plant, then it's coming to the dock to be loaded on the ships. I called Skagway with the same question. He said, interesting story.
I'll let you summarize.
Interesting story. Your cruise ship lines requested we do tests. We tested our municipal docks. They were below the average. The one private dock was above. It was all because of the ball valves. So, in summary, I think there's a lot that can be done, all basic stuff. It's the loading of the water on the ships, but it's also the copper pipes. That's what's causing the whole high copper counts. Once these ships are gone, this problem is over. Please don't give these guys an exemption. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Toma. Let's see. Looks like we have a couple people online to testify. We'll go to the Ketchikan LIO first. John Kimmel is online. John, can you hear us?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Just barely. Hang on a second. Let's check the technology here. Could you try again, John? Can you hear us now?
Can you hear me now?
Sounds like he's in the other room. She's still
Hello?
Working. She's still working the technology. Try it again, John.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. Go ahead and if you'd introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, please.
My name is John Kimmel, and I work for Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska. And just wanted to, you know, clarify a few things here with the previous speaker, I guess, pointing out that the cruise ships really need to be held to the same standard as everybody else. The original initiative held them to a higher standard than everyone else, and we're just trying to make it, this fix is going to make it more fair for the cruise lines. And, you know, just wanted to point out that it is basically about jobs as well. And my family depends on the cruise ships for the jobs in, or you know, the income. And it's interesting that the legislature came up with the science advisory panel, and they spent 3 years studying all of this. I think it's time that we move on and listen to what the advisory panel has to say, and also what DEC has to say. And that's all I have to say.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Kimmel, for your testimony. Then let's see. We've got someone else online, this time from Petersburg, Joseph Sebastian. Joseph, can you hear us?
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself with your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, for the record, my name is Joseph Sebastian. I'm representing myself and my family, who are all fishermen. I have been a fisherman in Southeast Alaska for 35 years, and I've watched the development of both the sport fish industry and the cruise ship industry in that amount of time. My son is a fisherman, and my daughter has worked in different aspects of the fishing industry and is currently a fisherman her own self. My children work their way through college on fishing boats. Our neighbors, who are fishermen, their son just bought a new boat and permit just in the last couple of days. Petersburg is a fishing town, as are many towns in Southeast Alaska. News flash. The fishing industry is the biggest employer in the state of Alaska. This bill is bad for Alaska's fishing industry. Our industry's whole claim, the clean, pristine waters and inlets, has to have a foundation in reality and in science and in public perception. I'm sure many of you have heard of ocean acidification. It's taking place due to airborne carbon pollution settling on the ocean in amounts that change the water's pH factor. Now SB 29 wants to add more pollution to our oceans to compound this already existing problem. Recently, the legislature flew off the handle to protect gun rights with a ban against the ban of certain guns and munitions. But what about our clean ocean and water rights, the same ocean we all make our living from? I am happy to share all of Alaska's wonders with our visitors, but these cruise lines, who make billions of dollars of profit every year, if they are unwilling to uphold and protect our clean, pristine Alaskan waters, then they really have no place here and are not welcome. This bill, SB 29, is a slap in the face to thousands of Alaskan fishing families and the fishing industry in general. And I would like to see the committee stay the course and see this through how we best can, through extensions for some if they need it. As Chip Thomas said, every year sees rapid advances, and I think we're on our way to achieving a good balance with an industry that can be more neutral than it is right at the present as far as discharges and water quality. So I think there's hope, but I would ask the committee to stay the course. And is it tough to do the right thing? Yes, it is. It is extra work. But I think the extra work would be worth worth the effort when it comes to Alaska's water and oceans. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sebastian. If you would like to submit your testimony in written form, you can do that through the LIO there. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's the end of my list of folks that have signed up to testify. Was there anyone else in the room that wished to testify? All right, we'll take one more person. We still have a few more minutes. If you would identify yourself, your affiliation, and please spell for our secretary, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Ridgway, R-I-D-G-W-A-Y, and I'm from Ok Bay, and I'm testifying on my own behalf. I will point out that I do serve as a member of the Alaska Cruise Ship Wastewater Science Advisory Panel. Again, I'm testifying on my own behalf. I'd like to say at the outset, I do not support Senate Bill 29 in its current form. I believe that the implications of introducing more ship discharge at the volume of the best estimate we have, some 800 cubic meters per day per ship times 20 ships times 180 days per year, is an unacceptable level of introducing contaminants into our ecosystem. And quite frankly, I think we'll be appalled by the long-term degradation of our marine ecosystem if we allow this to go forward in this form. The bill calls for establishing mixing zones for moving vessels. I caution you to avoid going down this path. I believe it will be exceedingly, excruciatingly difficult for Alaskans to concur on where it is within a 0 to 3 nautical mile area, our state waters, that we find it's acceptable for vessels to discharge water that contains copper, zinc, nickel, and ammonia at levels that are known to be acutely and chronically toxic to marine life that we all depend upon. Envision this. Where are we going to avoid subsistence harvesting areas? How are we going to avoid some of the established state water parks? Add to that avoiding the areas that are critical for our dive fisheries, our commercial fisheries, sport fisheries, and tourism to operate in clean water. Clean water is our brand. Wild and free is our mantra in Alaska, and I think now is the time to continue to protect that. There have been quite a number of studies that demonstrate clearly that metals at very low levels, especially copper, but also other metals that are constituents of the waste stream that are described by DEC records that are in the effluent, are toxic to marine life. They disfigure herring embryos. At very, very low levels, salmonid alevins, smolts, and adults lose their sense of smell, can't find their way home, and are susceptible to much higher levels of predation as a result of that. Not to mention, we have the unfortunate fact that heavy metals bioaccumulate in the food web. Small fish are eaten by larger fish, eaten by marine mammals, and so on, and bioaccumulation in metals, as within our own bodies, impacts our immune system, impacts that also of marine mammals. There is a tremendous literature, scientific literature, on these effects. You may hear from people that are not inclined to pursue finding a really good solution that there's no solution on the horizon. I would encourage you as a committee to get up off the deck level if necessary, and elevate yourselves up to the wheelhouse or out on the yardarm if you need to get a little higher and take a different perspective to look a little harder for a solution that is based on good, solid technology that does exist and good, solid scientists that exist, so that we can wed the two as we encourage our students to do, use solid science and pursue technological innovations to balance our industrial needs and protect our wild Alaskan marine waters. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And again, if you'd like to give us that in writing, you certainly may.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I've also been notified there were a couple other people on the phone. So there are two other folks on the phone. Is there anyone else wishing to testify today? All right. So we'll go ahead and take these other two people. The first one is Dave Wetzel. Mr. Wetzel, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me? Madam Chair?
Yes, very clearly. Go ahead and get on the record with your name and affiliation.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. My name is David Wetzel, W-E-T-Z-E-L. I'm the owner of Admiralty Environmental. And are you able to hear me?
Yes, very clearly.
Okay, I'll speak up. We're the independent contracting company that manages the sampling, monitoring, and testing of large and small cruise ships in Southeast Alaska. We've reviewed and reported a majority of the data that's been collected from these ships since the year 2000. And that gives us a perspective on the history of the monitoring program and where ships are now compared to where they have been. And I'll start by saying that we do support the passage of SB 29 as a sound and practical solution, an environmentally responsible way to approach cruise ship monitoring. Really what we're talking about here is just taking the Alaska water quality standards and applying them consistently for all people who discharge in Alaska, whether they're a wastewater treatment plant, a mining company, a cruise ship, any of those things. So we're not really looking at any kind of scale back of Alaska water quality regulations. We're just looking at applying all those things consistently across the board. We've seen all the major types of treatment systems that are in operation in Alaska and sampled and reviewed the results from all of those. These really are the best systems that are out there right now. The military is actually looking at applying some of these systems that have been developed just for the Alaska market. So there's a remarkable consistency between the different types of advanced wastewater treatment systems in that they all treat water to basically the same quality. This is between different ships of the same system, even between ships of the same ship from year to year. There's an enormous amount of consistency to the point where if you're presented with a set of data from a ship without any identification, it would be impossible to identify what kind of treatment system it came from. So it's really only sensible to apply the same strategy for effluent limitations to ships that we apply to land-based plants, because that's really the intent of the Alaska Water Quality Standards, or to establish limits for the quality of the water body itself. It's not a point of discharge standard. It's a water quality standard. The other thing to really consider is that the cruise ship discharges are much smaller volume than there are from land-based plants. So when we're comparing some of these things, and you're going to hear a lot of details about what comes out of the Menihal River, what comes out of cruise ships, but it's important to understand that the volumes that are coming out of cruise ships are quite small compared to what's being discharged from a municipal plant. And then another thing I want to make note of is that throughout this industry, my experience in dealing with the vessel owners of these is that they're all very committed to operating their systems properly in an optimal manner. They're also very interested in making sure that they're meeting regulations, and they're involved on a daily basis in how those results are coming out. You know, it's also very important to encourage vessels to use these wastewater treatment systems properly. The alternative, if we don't give them regulations that allow them to do this, is to encourage ships to discharge outside of regulated areas. And, you know, what we're really doing is just encouraging them to go just out of state waters and federal waters where it's just as sensitive as the salmon rearing habitat. So my personal opinion is that the current state of treatment is really effective, and I really urge you to pass this legislation, which will allow some reasonable and consistent and thorough monitoring of the ships, and will allow DEC to write a practical permit. And thank you. Those are all the comments I have. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Wetzel. If you'd like to submit it in writing, your testimony in writing, you can send it in through the LIO that you're at. The last person signed up, who's also online, is Rick Rogers. Can you hear us, Rick?
Thank you, Chairman Giesel. For the record, my name is Rick Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council for Alaska. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. RDC, as most of you know, is a statewide business association, and we represent five industries: forestry, oil and gas, mining, tourism, and fishing, and our mission is to grow responsible resource development. Over the last several years, one of our key priorities has been to encourage the state to promote and defend the integrity of Alaska's permitting process, which includes predictable, timely, efficient permitting processes that are based on good science and economic feasibility. We applaud the tireless work of the Cruise Ship Science Advisory Panel under the leadership of Commissioner Hartig and Deputy Commissioner Kent. This group met at least 15 times, to my knowledge, over 3 years, and came up with some really good, solid information to base a rational wastewater discharge policy for the cruise industry. I don't think this is a rushed process, given the amount of time and deliberation that has gone into that process that supports this bill. It's clear after reviewing the findings of that group and the recommendations of the Department of Environmental Conservation that meeting current water quality standards at the point of discharge from cruise ships is not feasible, but it's not necessary to protect public health and aquatic species. Senate Bill 29 establishes a policy that's based on sound science and economic feasibility. We have many small businesses and communities, many of whom are members of RDC, that rely on the cruise business activity for their livelihoods. And RDC supports quick passage of this bill to ensure reasonable permit processes and standards in place for the upcoming cruise season. The bottom line is the cruise industry has some of the cleanest discharge among dischargers in Alaska. It's better than many of our municipalities, our cruise ships, our fishing boats. And we're really troubled when we start singling out one industry over the other. Where I sit, you know, I represent a broad host of different industries. And when we go back to that key point about integrity of our permitting process, I think we need to be fair. We need to look at the true, the science and the impact on species and treat the effluent accordingly. So I really appreciate the ability to speak up on this and encourage quick deliberation on SB 29. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. So that concludes the folks that have signed up to testify. There are letters expressing opinions in your packet. I wanted to draw your attention to that. There's also a letter in here from DEC. We had some questions. Specific senators had questions last time we met, and there is written response to those questions. So at this time, I will close public testimony, and we will take the bill up again next week. Be sure to submit any amendments by Monday morning, so that the committee can review any amendments that you might want to submit. All right, so moving on to our next topic. Today we're going to wrap up the series on who's keeping the lights and heat on, looking for some solutions. We've certainly had the problem clearly defined to us over the last three or four meetings. And Alaskans are certainly saying it's time for action on the energy issue. So today we've got some folks here that are going to testify on some possible solutions to the energy issue. We have three folks testifying, so we'll evenly divide the time left in our committee meeting among these folks. We're going to hear from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation first. That will be followed by Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, or CINGSA, and then lastly, Fairbanks LNG Trucking. So we'll go ahead and start out with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and I believe Frank Richards is here to speak to us. Welcome, Mr. Richards. If you'd put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Frank Richards, Pipeline Engineering and Government Affairs with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And before I begin the presentation, our President Dan Fauske is online, and he might have a couple words of intro. So, Dan, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, he is on the line. Yes, if you could speak up just a little bit, Mr. Fauske, and go ahead and proceed with your statement. Identify yourself.
Madam Chair. First off, I apologize. This is Dan Fauske, President AGDC, CEO of Alaska Housing. I apologize for not being there. I made a valiant attempt, but the plane, we ran into some difficulties yesterday. So I'm glad Frank can be there. We're just happy to be here to give you this update. I know many of you received the latest updated version of the work that we've been doing. Frank's going to take you through the slides. We're very pleased with it, and we're here to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, thank you. We're presenting today is essentially a version that we presented to the In-State Gas Caucus recently. We've condensed it down due to the time constraints of the committee, so great. We're really thankful to be here and to tell you how we've advanced the project over the last year and a half since our last project plan update. As Dan said, that each one of you has in front of you, I believe, a project plan update, year-end report 2012. That's what defines all of the work that we've done and what I'll be presenting today, but in much greater detail. You also have, I believe, in front of you a PowerPoint pack slide, so I'll be walking that through that. For the committee members who weren't in the legislature before HB 369 created or mandated the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation develop a project plan for an in-state gas pipeline. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation is a subsidiary of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation charged with moving that project forward. The Alaska Standalone Project, or ASAP, is the project that we are developing to provide and meet the mandate given to us by HB 369, which was deliver gas to Alaskans from Fairbanks to Cook Inlet region at the earliest possible date and at the lowest possible cost. That's the charge given to us by the legislature, and that is what we are doing. The governor voiced his support recently for our project in the state of the state, and we greatly appreciate that, and so we're advancing that project with the intent provided to us. The progress that we've made over the last 2.5 years has really been quite significant for project development. For a project this size, potentially an $8 billion project, a mega project, we've advanced this project by essentially acquiring 604 miles of state right-of-way. We've applied for another 100 miles of federal right-of-way. We've completed a final environmental impact statement, which is essentially the NEPA document that was published in the Federal Register last October. Public comment period in November of 2012, and we're waiting any day now for a record decision coming from the Bureau of Land Management for that environmental document. So those are what we call assets the state now has in our portfolio to advance the project. As we've advanced the project through the environmental stage, we've seen that the world markets again are changing quite dramatically for natural gas. With the shale gas explosion down south and the shale oil boom, we're seeing that the market conditions for North American product is changing quite rapidly. Specifically, the natural gas liquids market has been impacted greatly. The original design concept was that this pipeline would flow natural gas liquids to be able to meet the need of or the desire of providing gas for the lowest possible cost. But that market has changed. And what was at once a premium to oil is now selling at a cost less to oil. So we, in this last year, changed our design concept to go from a rich or with rich gas stream with entrained natural gas liquids to a lean gas or utility grade gas. Benefit of that, I will now identify to you. On page 4 of the slide, it identifies the project plan concept for a 36-inch diameter pipe operating at 1,480 psi pressure, lower pressure than what we originally anticipated. Again, with a 12-inch lateral running from essentially Dunbar, or siding off the Alaska Railroad, into Fairbanks with a 37-mile pipeline, but with a reduction in the number of facilities that we need to push this gas. There will be a gas conditioning facility on the plant on the North Slope, and there will be a compressor station. But with the shift from rich to lean gas, we've reduced the number of compressor stations needed to be able to deliver the gas to Fairbanks and South Central. And it has allowed now for more offtake points for Alaskans, for Alaskan businesses, or major developments to tie into the line and acquire the gas at a very reasonable rate. All this means that we've been able to lower the tariffs for the consumers. The optimized plan benefits, as outlined on page number 5, identify that we've lowered the risk of the project. That's the operational risk, the construction risk, the financing risk. But first, let me identify the project plan that the constraints that we're working under is we are capped to a design, a flow of 500 million cubic feet a day. That's the geolimitation placed on any competing state-funded project. We cannot design a project for more than 500 million cubic feet. So that is the work that we are doing, only up to 500 million cubic feet a day. So as I talk through this project, again, with a larger diameter pipe and a gas conditioning facility, it is to 500 million cubic feet a day design concept. With that, as I said, we've eliminated costly facilities that were associated with the rich gas stream, a straddle plant for Fairbanks, which would have allowed the gas to be stripped of NGLs and utility-grade gas flowed to Fairbanks. We have reduced the footprint on the environmental aspects because we've reduced the number of facilities. And with that, the actual construction costs for those plant design have been reduced considerably. overall, the overall cost of the project is essentially the same as the original concept. Current cost estimates are $7.7 billion in 2012 dollars, as opposed to our delivered price last year of 7.5, but when we factor in inflation, it rose to about 7.7 in 2012 dollars. We are not in competition with the AGEA project. We are a project that is moving forward with the mandate given to us by the legislature, which is delivery of gas to Alaskans. So with that, Madam Chairman, on page 6, it identifies the stage gate approach that we are using in the development of the project. Many of you have gone to the IPA training, which talks about the front-end loading aspect of projects where there are specific decision points or stage gates that a project must go through to advance to the next stage. In 2011, we delivered a project, and we were at the end of FEL 2, front-end loading phase 1. So, I'm sorry, we are now into FEL 2 with the delivery of that project plan update. To advance this project, we'll take legislation, and it will take additional funding to be able to give us the necessary resources to be able to move the project forward to project sanction. That's at the end of FEL 3. We need to be able to move the project into an open season, which will take considerable amount of engineering work to refine the engineering numbers necessary to give accurate cost estimates to the producers and shippers who would like to commit gas to our project. On page 7 of our handout is the project schedule, the top portion of which was the schedule mandated by House Bill 369, which had legislation granting us in giving us the project portfolio in July of 2010 with a project completion in 2015. That was a very aggressive schedule of 5 years from project concept to project completion. We have now optimized the plan based on the time frames that have passed since then. As I said, we have passed FEL 1 into FEL 2, and I hope to be able to get to FEL 3 with the support of the legislature. With that, then, we would get to first gas in late 2019 and full transmission in 2020. So the milestones on that, on page 8, is that we would have an open season in late 2014. Again, granted on provisions of enabling legislation and appropriate funding, that would determine the commercial interest on our project. That's what we need, those firm transportation agreements, to be able to move forward to get to a project sanction in late 2015. If that's the case, we'd move forward to procuring the pipe, the gas conditioning facility, and then going forward with construction in the time frame of 2017 through 2019. That's 2+ years of construction, winter and summer spreads, 772 miles of pipeline, including the lateral, resulting in first gas in 2019 and full transmission in 2020. So this new design, this optimized design case, on page 9, we identify the tariff updates. We've changed the tariff inputs a little bit, and what that has resulted in is a significantly better tariff than we had projected back in 2011. So we have longer terms. We have updated our cost estimates. We've added contingencies to the cost estimates that were in there just to identify that we are trying to be realistic. And we've identified and changed the way that we've looked at the rate of return on equity for an equity partner, and then the debt equity split from 70-30 to 75-25, and then looked at the cost of impacts of delay and inflation. And then, Madam Chairman, on I believe it's slide number 10, is the tariff comparison. In the right-hand column, we see that in 2012 dollars, the tariff to deliver gas to Fairbanks is in the range from $4.25 to $6. And for the Cook Inlet Basin, from Matsu to Kenai, it's $5 to $7.25. That's the cost of the pipe and the operation of the pipe. The levelized terms are below it. It's $4.75 to $6.50 for Fairbanks and $5.75 to $8 for Big Lake. The cost drivers that you see at the bottom of this slide are significant factors that would impact or could impact, lower or increase the tariff to the project. the capital cost, if it creeps up or down by $1 billion, then it's an impact of 50 to 80 cents between Fairbanks and Anchorage. Wow. If there's a state contribution to the project, a capital appropriation of $1 billion, it reduces the tariff by 45 cents. If the rate of the return on the private equity is reduced or increased, it's a 20 cent per million BTU impact. And the useful life of the project has been advanced 10 years. But the useful life of the bond is by adding 10 years, then it reduces it by 75 cents. So that results then, Madam Chairman, in the cost as identified on slide number 11. Here we show for Anchorage an optimized cost to the consumer from 9 to 11.25 per million BTUs. And in Fairbanks, a cost from $8.25 to $10 per million BTU. Those are significantly better rates than we had provided previously. But we give it as a range because we feel that there's still some uncertainty as we move forward because we don't have the specifics at this level of engineering. Overall, the project cost to Alaskans, we estimate to be $400 million to fund the work through FEL 3, two project sanction. And at that point, then an ownership model determination would be made to advance this project either as a state project, a private project, or something in between. The benefit to Alaskans is a long-term natural gas supply for Alaskans. It's an economic benefit in that it allows new economic opportunities to know that they're going to have an energy source for power generation, for equipment operation, for resource development. So we see that it has benefit across the board. Our project cost, as I said, is $7.7 billion in 2012. And with the contingency, again, that plus or minus 30%, because at the 10% level of engineering that we're at, we are trying to show that there is room for improvement or there's room for some slippage. Madam Chairman, the cost, again, as identified to the cost to consumer, includes what we feel is our assumptions are a $2 cost of gas in Prudhoe Bay to purchase and a $2 cost for distribution. That's currently the NSTAR rate that we as consumers are paying in the Anchorage Bowl. And we use that same $2 cost for distribution in Fairbanks as an assumption because nothing has been built yet. And as we see those numbers being refined, we will advance those numbers. So as I said, the funding that's necessary to move this project forward is really key to us being able to meet the schedule that we've just identified. If we're fully funded, we'll be able to advance the facilities and pipeline engineering to get us through to an open season and a class estimate that will be deemed usable by the shippers and producers that would want to commit to our pipeline. We would advance the regulatory permitting activities and agency engagements to finalize and move forward both state and federal permits that are necessary to work the pipeline. And we'd work on a engineering field investigation that would do our geotechnical, our hydrologic, our cultural resource efforts to be able to move this project forward in a timeline necessary. If we're only partially funded, again, only partial work is done and it advances the time necessary to complete the project. So project funding is necessarily key. And on
excuse me, Mr. Richards, Senator Machicki had a question.
Quick question for you, Mr. Richards. Your 2.5% inflation, would that also apply to the burner tip cost to the consumer per million BTU if the project is delayed additional time as well?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes, the 2.5% is the cost for all the construction products, any of the construction equipment. It's across the board, 2.5%.
So does that carry through to the consumer price on inflation?
Burner tip. Yes, sir. Okay. That's a factor in the tariff.
So looking at the in 2012 dollars, but are we looking at the 2019 delivered price, or do we have to calculate the inflation into those 2012 dollars?
On slide number 10, I think the tariff comparison, you'll see the levelized tariff at project startup at $4.75 to $6.50 for Fairbanks, or essentially 50 cents more that's the cost of inflation factored into the tariff over the life of construction.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up,
yes,
Mr. Richards.
Madam Chairman, again, the critical legislation necessary to advance the project is confidentiality, the funding, the authority to determine ownership, and contract carrier status. So, Madam Chairman, we appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee. We're advancing a project, and we're ready to do the will of the legislature.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Dyson? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator McGuire.
Thank you so much. Through the chair, I just have one question, and I was going to wait until you got to that part, and you just did. On page 3, under the recommended legislative actions, that is the part where you discuss addressing the issue of contract versus common carrier. And the last sentence says that the Alaska Gas Line Development Commission has virtually no chance, or corporation rather, has virtually no chance of attracting adequate shipping commitments or financing as a common carrier. And I just wanted you to expand on that a little bit because, as you know, my bill from the Senate side was merged with the House bill that made this. And, you know, certainly that wasn't my intention, that it be exclusive in that it be a contract carrier. This is a new notion coming out of House Bill 9, and I, as this comes forward, I just would like to hear a couple statements on the record about it. You did an expression of interest at one point that was very successful. It was a confidential expression of interest, but you were able to describe to us that at least half of a BCF of gas was potentially there for bidding for firm transportation offers. So I guess I'd ask, that expression of interest, was it made known to the folks in the room that there was no possibility that it would still be a common carrier?
Madam Chair, Senator McGuire, the best person to address this question is our commercial manager, and I believe he's online with Dan.
Okay, and that would be who?
Daryl Kleppen.
All right. Daryl, are you online?
Madam Chairman, Daryl Kleppen in Anchorage, commercial manager for AGDC.
Great. Can you answer the question? And
well, I'll answer it as I think I've heard it. Is first of all, in HB 9, contract carriage was part of that legislation. And fundamentally, oil pipelines tend to be common carriers, and gas pipelines tend to be contract carriers. And that was the way under AGEA with APP and also with the Denali project, they were contract carriers. And the reason for this is in order to finance the pipeline long-term with revenue bonding, the one supplying the funding needs a guaranteed income stream to pay off the bonds. And you only get that through long-term contractual commitments where the shipper has to pay the tariff whether they bring the gas to the pipeline or not over the period or term of the contract. And typically those contracts are long, minimums in for Denali and APP was 20 years, and they offered terms all the way out to 35 years, and our project is consistent with what they have done. So, again, the contract carriage doesn't mean that down the road, for example, and this is consistent with the AGEA, if someone wanted to come in south of the 68th parallel, they could still enter into the pipeline, but they would have to pay any expansion costs, and their terms would be different than the shippers originally in the pipeline.
So I'm
not sure I answered your question, but I hope I did.
Senator McGuire has a follow-up.
Yeah, so just specifically to the point, many of the members on this committee are familiar with the topic, and there are two different ways of doing gas pipelines as well. And certainly some gas pipelines are done as common carriers, and that discussion was had in the AGEA debate as well. And one of the issues is whether or not you can allow for competition into the marketplace to benefit the consumer over a long-term period. And you're right, the question is who pays for the expansions, and whether that's completely on the shoulders of the new entrant, or whether that cost is borne out over all of those who've made firm transportation offers. And so I just say there's more discussion on it. But the specific question I had was, and you're right, House Bill 9 had that in it, but the enabling legislation never did have it. And so my question was, at the expression of interest, and maybe this is one for Dan, where under 369, when you brought the private sector interests into the room and had that moment where you were able to deduce that there was half a B of firm transportation offer interest, was it made known that you were going to come back later and say this is a contract carrier line? Because at that moment in time, there was no delineation.
Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
This is Dan Fauske.
Yes.
To Senator McGuire, that really wasn't part of the discussion, Senator, during the EOI expression of interest meetings. If you recall, the maximum use at Fairbanks at 60 million feet a day and the South Central region at 180, around 240 million feet a day, what we were trying to determine if there was a commercial interest to utilize the other 260 million or 50 million feet of gas a day, getting to the total of 500. We were, through a non-binding arrangements and discussions, able to max the line out at the 500 million feet. We've had some discussions with people subsequent to that that were concerned about their inability to get into the line, and we'd explained that through looping and or added compression, that certainly presents an avenue for more gas to get in the line. At 500 million feet, we weren't anticipating a great deal of concern because, to be quite candid, I can't imagine explorers or producers getting too revved up over that amount of gas. In real terms, ladies and gentlemen, it's really a small amount of gas. Was much more pertinent to the debate on an AGEA line where you're at 3.5 to 4 billion feet of gas a day. But to Senator McGuire's concern, we have had numerous discussions on it, and as this process continues, we can continue to have those discussions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Senator Bishop, a brief question, as we have two other folks we need to speak with tonight.
We'll see you next Thursday. Be ready.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Yes, in Energy Committee, in Special Committee on Energy, yes, where this will be delved into more deeply, and Senator McGuire, of course, is on that committee, so you better be ready, Mr. Richards.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks very much. All right, the next person on our agenda, or the next group on the agenda, is CINGSA, the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, Alaska. And online we have Richard Gentges and Moira Smith. They're both online. Okay, great. So whichever of you would like to present, I'm starting a timer at 15 minutes. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is Rick Gentges. I'm speaking on behalf of CINGSA this afternoon with Moira Smith. I'm the project manager for the CINGSA project. Just wanted to say thank you up front for an opportunity to speak today. Do you folks have a copy of the slides, either on screen or a hard copy?
Yes, we do have hard copy. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Then what I'll do is I'll just refer to the specific slide that I'm talking about as we leap through them. So if you'd flip to slide number 2, that's titled CINGSA Overview. Wanted to first start off by giving folks a little bit of an overview of the project itself, for those of you that may not be familiar with it or as familiar. The CINGSA project involved the conversion of a production field, the Cannery Loop gas field, to a gas storage facility. We actually looked at about 50 prospects all across the Cook Inlet before selecting this one. It originally contained about 26.5 billion cubic feet of gas in the reservoir. It produced about 23 billion cubic feet of gas from the time it was discovered in October of 2000 until the time that CINGSA acquired it in July of 2011. It's actually very well suited for South Central Alaska's market today and longer term, and part of the consideration was that very fact. The original design considerations, the key metrics, if you will, this facility was designed to store 11 billion cubic feet of working gas and 7 billion cubic feet of base gas, and I'll talk a little bit more about those just so folks understand the difference. Base gas, first, is gas that is essentially put into the reservoir, and it stays there. It's there to establish a minimum operating pressure level so that the cycling of gas in and out of the field can be carried out more efficiently. In the case of this particular field, that minimum pressure is 600 pounds per square inch. And that's associated with when Singsa has all 7 BCF of base gas in the ground. Working gas, in contrast, is the volume of gas or capacity that we actually cycle in and out of the reservoir. It's the gas essentially that we've contracted for with customers to store. And in this case, the working gas can typically be cycled into and out of the field in about 150 days either way. So about 120 to 150 days to pull it out of the ground, and we can put it in just about as fast. So typically, this facility and storage fields in general, gas is injected during the summer, the warmer portion of the year, of course, and then it's withdrawn or produced back to the market during the winter. The deliverability, the design deliverability of this field was or is a maximum of 150 million cubic feet a day. That is not a sustainable withdrawal rate or injection rate for the entire inventory. It actually drops off by about 50% as the field reaches its maximum capacity, and then likewise when the field is on withdrawal, it falls to about 50% of that. And it does so because pressure declines as we're producing the gas out, and pressure is what actually, you know, provides the driving force for deliverability. So based on some limited testing that we have done on the field thus far, the actual maximum deliverability is close to the design level. It appears we're a little bit short. And in terms of long-term performance, you know, when we first designed this facility, we estimated that it would take about 5 wells to sustain that 150 million cubic feet a day maximum deliverability rate. From the test data that we've gathered thus far, and again, this is fairly limited, it appears as though we may need 2 more wells to actually do that. I'm going to flip to slide number 3 now, actually slides 3, 4, and 5 provide a summary of the permits that Singsa had to obtain in order to actually construct this facility. Just to give you folks a little context of timing, from concept to actual operation of this facility, it took about 36 months. And that's fairly typical for this type of facility. During the permitting process, we worked very closely with the Office of Major Projects within the DNR. That provided us with some very significant efficiencies in the overall permitting process, I believe. And I think it probably expedited the overall approval process. I've been involved in the construction of a number of these facilities over the course of my career in the past 32 years, and I have to say that the approval process, working through the Office of Major Projects in the DNR was probably one of the most efficient in my experience. So,
Mr. Gentges?
I'm not going to go through each of these permits. We really just provided them here to give you folks a sense of what's involved in actually constructing a facility of this nature. There were over 30 permits, local, state, and federal, required for us to construct this facility. The review and approval times for each of the permits ranged from as small as actually a couple of days for some of them to over a year for a few of them. We had numerous public hearings at all levels of government and actually a very thorough review process. We really had excellent cooperation from all the agencies, and particularly the folks in the DNR. They, again, were very helpful in the overall permitting process. The key message here is that this project, I think, was very well vetted, and I think by virtue of that process, it allowed things that address concerns, and in some cases, we actually modified the design somewhat to address those concerns. The other thing I would say about this is that this is the first project I've been involved with in Alaska, but I've done this in several other states in the lower 48, and this is the process we went through here is actually very consistent with most other states, and in fact, other countries. I've actually been involved in looking at storage development in Canada and Mexico and to some extent some European countries, and the process varies a little bit, but the overall process here and approval and permitting process was pretty consistent with what you'll see just about anywhere else. We commissioned the injection facilities and began operations in April of 2012. And overall, we have in the construction phase of this project about 300,000 man-hours of labor, all without a single lost time incident or injury. At our peak, we had between 150 and 170 contractors on site at any given time. So, again, just to kind of give you a sense of scale and the effort involved in doing this.
Mr. Gentges?
Skip ahead now. Yes.
Senator French had a question.
Thank you, and that's a great summary of how we got where we are. But I just wanted to ask you, while we're here, and I know we're short of time, but you know, SINGSO was sort of like a just-in-time solution to Cook Inlet gas supply problems. I think the whole legislature can be proud of itself for sort of having gotten on this bandwagon in time to get you started. You finished the project on time, and it's a good thing you did, because if we didn't have it, some of us in South Central would be short of gas, and that's a bad thing. So my question is, and we're looking at a lot of long-term solutions to Cook Inlet gas supply, but we've got an immediate problem that's right coming up on our horizon, either next winter or the winter after. Why is more storage would expand? Your last slide talks about expanding SINGSO. Would expanding SINGSO or building another similarly sized facility help us through the short-term Cook Inlet gas supply problem we have?
That's a very good question. I think to the extent that gas supply locally is available and that it can be stored during the summer months, the short answer, Senator, is yes, it could help, certainly from a short-term perspective, because if the gas can be produced in the summer months and put into the SINGSO facility when demand is lower and then produced back and delivered to the market when demand is higher, that is unquestionably a good short-term solution.
All right. Thank you. If you could wrap up now, so I'll let you give you a couple more minutes.
Certainly. Just briefly on slide six, this is we wanted to share with you a snapshot of really the first test of SINGSO. This is about an eight-day look at how the facility performed. This is the period right before Christmas. I suspect those of you that were in Anchorage remember how cold it was. What we found during this period was that we actually had a good test of the facility. The withdrawal rates to meet our customer nominations ranged from about 60 from 40 to 60 million a day. We had peak rates of about 80 million a day, and the performance was largely consistent with our expectation. We saw some degree of improving performance out of some of the wells, but we need a little bit more operating data to more fully vet that. So, but this is actually very good news. It helps us to, you know, validate the overall performance. And with that, I'll let Moira finish up with slide number 7.
For the record, this is Moira Smith on behalf of Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, Alaska. And just speaking briefly to slide 7, I know we're short on time. We have received, CINGSA has received a request for an expansion of its facility. We always knew that the reservoir we selected had additional capacity available, and we contemplated both in our tariff and in the commercial arrangements that we might at some point move to an expansion to allow for extra storage capacity within the reservoir and also additional deliverability from the reservoir. And so we are now in the process of considering our reaction to that request for expansion, in addition to considering the possibility of drilling 2 additional wells to ensure that we can perform at the contracted and designed capacity under the current arrangement, which is the 150 million cubic feet a day to which Mr. Gentius referred. And that's pretty much what we wanted to say in terms of our presentation. We are certainly available for questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Moira. We have run out of time for this segment, though, again, our Special Committee on In-State Energy, co-chaired by Senator Bishop. Senator McGuire is also on the committee. I'm sure you'll be addressing some of these issues in the future as well. So thank you very much, Mr. Gentius and Ms. Smith. Our last presenter today is on the Fairbanks LNG trucking option to meet the needs of the interior, and the person testifying on that topic tonight is Jean Theriault. So I would invite you to the table, Mr. Theriault. Thank you. Online also we have Mark Davis and Jim Strandberg, both from ADA. So if you need a lifeline, they're available, I think. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I believe we also have from the AEA side of the House, Nick Simoniak, who has been the project economist, and so if there are questions about the modeling that has been done on this project, hopefully Mr. Simoniak can answer them. I'd like to just quickly walk through the slide packet and let you know that the packet that is before you was developed to give a presentation to the combined AEA board on the 10th of January, and so I realized after it was distributed and printed that there were no page numbers on, but I've written one, and I'll just refer to page 1, page 2. So if we start on page 2, just the goal. The goals that we are working this project on are those that were established by the administration. And what I want to just touch on here is the project goal, the project team, the approach to finance, and the schedule and milestones. So you can see on actually page 3, the project goals that were established by the governor was to provide the lowest cost energy to the most interior Alaskan consumers as soon as possible, with the supply of gas trucked down from the North Slope. The plan is to get the gas first to the interior market, the core of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but the administration's view is that this plant will actually be available to serve a much larger geographic area over time. It, however, is that core demand in interior that gets the product flowing, hopefully. And then the third point is the administration wants to utilize the power of the private sector as much as possible to make this project workable. Then if we get to slide number 4, which is sort of the meat and potatoes of the economic modeling that we've done so far, I'd like to just run you through the assumptions on the left-hand side there. What we've done at AEA, because we have not engineered a plant, but we know that there are private sector entities out there that have done a lot of work on engineering. So what we did is tap into the best engineering information that we could get from Fairbanks Natural Gas, who last year was working on a 7 BCF project concept, and Flint Hills and Golden Valley that had been working on a 9 BCF concept. So we pulled that information in, And you can see then, under the key assumptions, the modeling that we have done is built on around that 9 BCF plant. And it wasn't that we decided to choose that one because that was what was being proposed by Golden Valley, but we had to choose some capacity and then move the information that we received from both sides so that we could do a head-to-head comparison. In addition, we have assumed that there's $50 million of capital that is available. And when we looked at the plant, we anticipate that it serves what I term a public need, that is electric generation that is distributed through a regulated distribution system, and natural gas that is distributed through a regulated pipe system. That's sort of the demand over on what I consider to be the public side. In addition, we anticipate, in fact, an ADA review back in 2009 said that the economics of the overall enterprise also needs to tap into industrial demand so that we can get a larger volume. So what we did is we looked at sort of bifurcating the plant, that 9 BCF plant, 4.5 BCF initially to sort of that public need, 4.5 BCF to the industrial need. And then what we did is we took any state support, capital appropriation, and focused that on paying down the debt component on the public side of the plant. Now, the plant wouldn't really be divided, and there would only be one stream of product coming out. But what we're anticipating is that there would be one price that would have a lower debt component that serves that public need, and another price that would be utilized to price the commodity for industrial need. And the concept there is that the industrials, they would be getting the benefit of being part of a larger overall volume plant, but they can more likely afford to carry the full debt component that would go along with the LNG produced on their side. Then in addition, the regas and storage and distribution costs are presented here in a range, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. And then the expected utility price per MCF, you can see we're getting down to a wholesale, and that's when you add up the price of gas, that's the red bar, the price of the plant, that's the blue bar, and the trucking, that's, you know, putting it in the trucks, the salaries, the tires, changing the oil, fueling up the trucks, and delivering it into the city gate. What I'd like to focus then, and you can see, we believe then we can achieve or get close to a $10 delivery price in bulk to the community. Now, if I could focus on the orange bars and like to explain why we've got two shadings there. We had price information on the build out of the distribution from FNG, which is currently in the business of piping gas to a relatively small number of consumers in Interior. And so, therefore, they have more internal data as far as how much does each foot of pipe cost? How much does it cost to bore under a road? How much does it cost to hook up a new consumer, industrial versus residential? And so based on their information, and what they saw was the economics of the ideal build-out, they thought that they could do the storage, regas, and distribution on a price that would push the total up to the top of that solid orange box, okay? Then we also had some price information on a larger build-out of distribution that was done by the FEDCO, the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, and their desire is to actually see that distribution system pushed out further. So as you push the pipe out further, the number of houses that you're serving on each mile of pipe drops down, so the cost that's serving that next house goes up. So that is attributable to part of why they saw those costs being a little bit higher. They saw that system going out a little bit more broadly. In addition, their prices were built around an engineer's estimate. And that engineer's estimate had a range of variability of plus or minus 30 to 40%. So that is attributable to why from the top of the green bar to the top of the shaded orange, why we see that as being the highest cost for distribution in the local area. We believe at ADA AEA that the realistic price is probably somewhere between the top of the solid orange and the top of that orange shaded. And so if we sort of split the difference, and part of the reason is we've heard from FNG that, again, because they've been boring under streets, they've been buying pipe by the mile, they've looked at the estimates that Fedco based their estimation on, and they say, well, we think their costs are a little bit too high. We see what their estimated cost for pipe is. We know what we've purchased it for, and so we think, you know, they're a little bit high, probably due to the engineers being conservative and just sort of estimating on the high side. So if we sort of split the difference there of that shaded orange part, you can see that we think we can deliver gas to residential consumers at about $15 an MCF of gas. And the Fedco work that was done, sort of arbitrarily, they determined what they wanted to try and achieve for the residential consumer in the community was to, when you look at this black bar over in the far hand, right-hand side, which is the current cost for 1 million BTUs of heat that's generated with fuel oil, they wanted to cut that in half. And we believe with the financing and support package that the governor has laid on before you in legislation, that if that is applied to this project, we can get in the ballpark of potentially achieving that target for the community. So again, Mr. Simoniak has been in charge of taking the best information that we could get from the project proponents in the community, building our own model, giving it to them to look at, criticize, but so that we could run different scenarios based on, you know, our assumptions, but hopefully, though, underpinned by the economic information that was developed with the best engineering work so far on the project. The next slide.
Excuse me, Mr. Terrio. Yes. Senator French had a question.
Before we leave this slide about the cost and so forth, we recently had a presentation here in the committee comparing several different methods of getting gas to South Central from Anthony Scott. And I don't know if you got that presentation, but I'm just wondering whether your numbers are consistent with the numbers he presented to the committee.
I know Mr. Simoniak and Mr. Scott have talked. Again, we're encouraging economists to talk to economists, not to collaborate on a model, but to sort of scrutinize
their numbers. And for all I know, he pulled your numbers into his presentation. I just don't know, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. And Nick, are you online at this point? Nick Simoniak, are you online? I guess not.
You can follow up with an email or whatever works.
I think from my limited understanding of Mr. Scott's presentation is that the lines might not line up perfectly, but Nick believes that it's largely due to some different assumptions. And when you adjust for those assumptions, we get pretty close.
Same ballpark. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
But I'll look at a more detailed answer.
Interested. Yep. Thank you. Yes.
Okay, now if we can go on to slide number 5. This is just a written explanation of sort of the project components. The natural gas would be secured on the north slope, liquefied in a plant, put into trucks, trucked into the community where it would be then stored in cryogenic tanks, regassed, and then distributed. Or if you were an industrial user, you might have a small cryogenic tank right at your plant site, where you store your own product, take delivery right into your tank, regas, and then use it in your industrial process. That would be a possibility. The next slide, slide number 6, is just a depiction of that infrastructure. And then slide number 7 gives an idea of the project team that we've put together. ADA and AEA are sister authorities, both within the Department of Commerce. And you can see on the AEA side, it's myself, Kirk Warren, who's a technical engineer, Mr. Simoniak, the project economist, and on the ADA side, we have Mark Davis, who is the director of looking at the financing of the operation and the business structure, and then Mr. Strandberg working on the energy development and financing officer on the ADA side. Slide number 8 shows that we believe this is a collaborative structure. AEA is leading the tracking the policy. Again, going back to the policy statements that the governor said he wanted to apply to this project, the package of financing and state support that he wanted to supply to it. We're watching that, modeling that on the AEA side. And though over on the ADA side, you probably recently heard that ADA put out a request or solicitation for letters of interest to sort of the broadly distributed, just wondering who might be out there that was interested in taking advantage of the financing and support package that the governor proposed, that wanted to bring either a turnkey proposal or technical engineering expertise, financing expertise to the mix, so that if we were to not select a turnkey proposal, but we're looking at pulling together a collaborative team on the project, would we actually have, did we have people out in the private sector that were interested in entering into that? We have publicly disclosed that we had 16 responses to that solicitation for letters of interest. The list of respondents has been distributed. The Fairbanks News Miner was interested in getting that information. And I think when you look at the list, you can see that some of them are likely have, you know, been turned in a turnkey. Others, Guggenheim Financing, most likely interested in financing, and other engineering firms interested in project management and engineering expertise. On slide number 9, you can see that we now are moving forward and bringing on within the ADA AEA team some engineering expertise. We hope to make a decision on that by January 31st. That's just next Friday. We're also planning on bringing on a project management consultant, but due to our procurement process, probably not likely to have that on board until sometime in February. And also we've already got a financial consultant and business consultant on board as part of the team. Slide number 10 gets to the financing package that the governor put on the table, which totals $325 million, plus the storage credit allowance that was passed in legislation last year. If you consider that the project could avail itself of two storage credits, because we have storage associated with the liquefaction plant on the North Slope, and then storage associated with the receipt and regas in the community, that legislation allowed for a sharing of cost of 50% up to a total of $30 million. So each storage tank could potentially qualify for $15 million of state assistance, with two storage plants potential in the infrastructure, that's a total of $30 million. So the administration considers that right now the complete package that is being offered up by the state is a total of $355 million. Comprised of those components. And then on slide number 11, we get into a little bit more of the breakdown. As part of the governor's budget package, he did indicate a $50 million appropriation capitalization of ADA to potentially take an ownership stake in this infrastructure. Could be very similar to lots of the other infrastructure the state of Alaska is owner in. We don't actually manage and operate them, but we can take an ownership stake if it helps to actually finance the operation. There is also a request legislation that's introduced that requests that ADA be authorized to issue up to $50 million worth of bonds that would be then used within ADA as a source of funding for loans that would go out. And the attempt there is to bring those bonds in. So the capital that would be available through loans would be at or below 3% interest. And then in addition, within the governor's budget, there is an additional capitalization of the SETS program that was set up last year. It was initially capitalized with $125 million, but the governor didn't want to indicate an attempt to utilize SETS, the current capitalization of SETS. He's bringing the suggestion of an additional capitalization of $125 million that would be steered and utilized by ADA for this project. And so that adds up then to the $325, and then you see the $30 million from the storage credits. Page number 12 is the expected timeline as we go forward, and I'm hoping that Mr. Strandberg is online telephonically, hopefully, that he might be able to answer questions on that timeline, if you have any. And then the final is just the contact information for ADA. So with that, Madam Chairman, I'm available to answer questions if the committee members have them.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Terrio. We are at the end of our time. Are there any questions? Senator Bishop.
Gene, it's great. Look forward to seeing you, I think, next week in State Energy Committee, and we're going to get down into the nuts and bolts of this and look forward to a good comprehensive discussion. I want to thank Madam Chairman for kind of teeing this up and giving other members that aren't part of the In-State Energy Committee this good snapshot overview, and I appreciate that. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Mr. Terrio.
Madam Chairman, and to the Senator's comment, thank you. I believe the ADA personnel will be in, the folks from the ADA side of the team, and I'm likely to be on teleconference right. next week. But one of the things that we would like to leave you with is we have developed a core capability within ADA and AEA to run different numbers. We've built this model, and if committee members wanted to know, well, what happens if you make changes in the governor's suggested plan, what happens to the then delivered price? We can run those changes to the model and get those answers to committee members fairly rapidly.
Great, thank you. So committee members, thank you very much for being here today. Our next meeting will be Monday at the usual time. We're going to start informational hearings in anticipation of the oil tax bill coming to us. Also, I want to let committee members know, and the public, just a little bit of a heads up. We will have a Saturday hearing on February 2nd to hear some bills, and then a public testimony potentially around February 23rd on the oil tax bill. So just a little bit of a heads up there on some Saturday meetings. That should be all, though. Thanks very much, and the meeting is now adjourned. The time.